Hello, everyone. I'm Drew.
Bailey.
I'm Lacey.
And we're sarcastic, so let's get sinister. I would like this hair to, like, make a choice.
Have we ever recorded this early in the morning?
I don't think so.
I appreciate everyone's cooperation. Well, at first, when you were like, yeah, I'm good whenever, I started texting you guys and said, how about 8? And then I was like, let's back it up. It's a Sunday morning.
Yeah, what are you doing later that we can't...
Paula and my mom are coming over at noon.
So they could listen while we record?
That's what I originally was going to do. I was like, well, they can just hang out with each other since they love each other while I record. And then I was like, well, let me just see if everybody can do the morning, because if they can, then... they don't have to do that. So
when I said I'm good anytime, I didn't want to have to set an alarm. And I didn't, but I did wake up as soon as I texted you, give me 5.
I do appreciate your sacrifice on this Sunday morning.
You're welcome.
In my case, Sundays is when I get to sleep in, because Lewis is home with the kid, like, all night.
Yeah.
Because Saturdays, he works Friday into Saturday. So Sundays is when he's home overnight. So I get to sleep in.
So basically, Lacey, you owe us coffee.
No, I think it'll she just, like... Okay. Should I felt like nine really a, think about her
yeah.
herself.
I got to sleep in a little bit today.
Got it. What's keeping you up at night?
Peeing. I'm not up as much as you are at night, though, I imagine.
Oh, I'm sure.
I went to bed at midnight.
Oh. Did you catch the Phillies game?
Yeah, and that was profoundly disappointing.
We were actively watching, but then my sister-in-law and her husband came over. Dana and Kyle, I don't know why I'm speaking in code. They came over and Kyle had it up on his phone and he was like, we just got to the top of the 8th and we're just giving up all the runs. And I was like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
How are their baby?
So good. It's weird because we're on like almost the exact same timeline. So I was like, a year ago today, you were the size of a jalapeno. And now there you are.
You were telling the baby that?
Yes, I did. I thought he'd like it.
My baby is teething, so he's up in the nighttime more often because his mouth hurts.
Yeah.
Sucks. You should do something about that.
I am just like, I feel like he's been teething for a month, so I'm really hoping that two of them come in at once. Because then we're not good for... out. Yeah, because what I think the oldest one did was she was just miserable for like a good year, because they would just come in one after another and they didn't want to tag team it. It was really rude. All right. Are we ready?
Yes.
Yeah. Is this our 100th episode though?
Oh my goodness, it is. Well, I would just like to it's technically not because we had the mini episodes.
Oh, they don't count.
But is it our 100th like regular
yes episode? It's going to pop up on the screen as episode 100, Gary Heidnik part 2.
Hey, can you make this, didn't you find a thing on Riverside where you can make sounds in the background?
Oh,
is there like a celebration sound?
Hold on.
Claps for us.
Not this fucking thing again.
All right.
Calm down, guys. It's okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Say something funny.
Too much pressure. You're right. It was funny.
Yeah. All right. Was that good?
I think so.
Yes.
We're good to start now.
So let's get in to part two.
All right, that's the soundboard.
Yeah, I was having fun with it.
Sorry. Can you remind us where we left off? Because I don't remember exactly.
Yes, obviously.
I remember you confused us when you cut off, but I don't remember what had happened.
How did I confuse you when I cut off?
Because I wasn't ready for it to be a part two. And
yeah,
then it was
you
like,
also
oh,
were like,
even later.
It was like in the middle of like a paragraph or like a sentence or something.
No,
and then you were like,
I was in the middle of an event. I left you on a cliffhanger. Mm.
Yeah, and I didn't appreciate it.
Okay.
I already get that from my books, okay? I don't need a cliffhanger in real life.
Real life cliffhangers are stressful.
That's true. I was going to say that kind of, I don't know. I feel like real life cliffhangers are a thing. All right, so let me get to, as soon as, like I have like a paragraph ready to, as like a recap. So I was already ready to do that, Lacey. Are you ready?
Yes.
So to recap what we've talked about thus far, Gary Heidnik, let me pull up his photo for you. Go. Gary Heidnik had a fantasy of having a wife and kids, but his wife left him and took his son, and his two other children were in foster care. So he started kidnapping and imprisoning women in November of 1986. In March 1987, he had abducted five women, but he killed Sandra Lindsay in February of 1987. Josephina, the first victim, had gained his trust by being obedient and understanding to him. And when we stopped, Gary had come home to find the women screaming for help, so he punished them with electrocution. Debbie refused to stop screaming, so Gary held the live wire against her chains for minutes until the basement got quiet. And that's where we left off.
That's
right. Didn't he make Josephina do that too to her?
Yeah, so he did it, and then when they wouldn't stop, he gave it to Josephina and she did it. And then he was getting really irritated and took it back and then just held it against Debbie's chains until she stopped screaming. So Debbie was murdered. I feel like you guys probably could have figured that out.
Yeah, that was my guess.
Gary had Josephina write a letter that said, Gary Heidnik and Josephina Rivera electrocuted Deborah Dudley in the basement of 3520 North Marshall Street. Then they both signed it, and Jackie signed as a witness. He told Josephina that now he could trust her because of the letter. Then he said he was going out to find a place to dump Debbie's body. When Gary returned, he had with him a New Jersey map. He took Josephina with him to help, and together they left Debbie's body in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey. About a week later, Gary put Lisa and Jackie in the hole, covered it with the boards, and took Josephina on another outing. They were driving down Girard Avenue and Philly when they passed a girl Josephina knew. Her name was Agnes Adams. She was 24 years old. There's a picture of all six of his victims. Gary told Josephina that if she helped him abduct Agnes, he would let Josephina contact her family after he finished with Agnes. Josephina complied, and Heidnik took Agnes back to his house. He raped her upstairs, then took her down to the basement. Josephina asked if she could go to her family's house to say goodbye, because she was going to stay with him forever. She told him that she'd proven herself to him, and he could trust her. So Gary drove them to a gas station on the corner of Girard and 6th. Gary stayed in the car and told Josephina that she had 15 minutes. Josephina began to walk away, but as soon as she was out of Gary's sight, she ran. She ran to her house. She stopped when she reached a corner with a phone booth on it, and she called the police. Officers David Savage and John Cannon were in a squad car nearby and met Josephina at the corner. She was less than a mile away from the Sunoco where Gary was sitting and waiting. Josephina told them all about Gary and what had happened to her. The officers were skeptical, but seeing the chafing from the chains on her ankles, they drove the half mile to see if there really was a man sitting in a Cadillac at the gas station. Sure enough, as they approached, there he was. They ordered him to exit the vehicle as Josefina came back to the gas station. Heidnik initially asked, "What's this all about, officer? Didn't I pay my child support?" But Josefina confirmed that they'd found the right man, the man who'd raped, tortured her, and five other girls, killing two of them. The man who still had three women chained up in his basement. The officers and a lieutenant went to Heidnik's home. They found bars on the windows and metal doors. They entered the house and found the television on with the volume all the way up. They went to the basement, opened the door, descended the stairs, and found two women lying on a mattress on the floor. They were naked from the waist down, and their bodies were bruised. On the ankle of each woman was a heavy shackle and a long chain. In the corner of the basement, the officers found a hole covered with a board and bags of dirt holding the board down. They removed the bags and the board and found another woman, naked with her hands handcuffed behind her back and her ankle shackled. They used bolt cutters from the fire station to free them. Lieutenant James Hansen went to the freezer in the kitchen based on what Josefina had reported. He identified that there were indeed body parts in the freezer. So, Gary Heidnik was arrested on March 24, 1987. The 50 members of his congregation seemed to be shocked.
I forgot that he had...
Remember, he had a church.
He started a church, yeah. He had a
church, too.
And he, like, kept that going while he had, like, these girls.
Yeah. And do you know where he held meetings?
Probably in his
house.
They would meet every Sunday inside his home to hear his spin on the Bible. They claimed they had no idea that their beloved Bishop Heidnik was really a sadistic monster with victims just under their feet.
Wasn't there another time Josefina had, like, the opportunity to get away?
Yeah, so Gary had took Josefina to meet up with his friend John because, well, no, not John. No, yes, John. Gary wanted to talk to him about putting a fence in his backyard. Mm-hmm. And they had to leave to go get supplies. And John was like, "I can't fit three people in the cab of my truck. So what are we going to do with Josefina?" And Gary was like, "She can just wait at the gas station. It'll be all right." And so then John and Gary drove away and Josefina was left at the gas station. And John later reported that she didn't seem like a captive because there were cops there. And she didn't, like, run over to talk to them.
Yeah.
She just sat and waited.
Why'd she choose this moment?
I think because Gary gave her 15 minutes. She knew that he wouldn't leave.
She knew
she
had a window.
Because I think that her thought was if he saw her running to the police at that gas station, he would just go home and kill the girls. But she was out of his sight for long enough that she felt like, he probably thinks that I'm just saying goodbye to my family. Meanwhile, I'm really getting the police here.
I was really surprised that he, like, even agreed to this with her. Because even though he's not been, like, the brightest, he has been successfully doing what he wanted to do. You know what I mean? Like, he had...
Yeah.
I feel like we talked about it the last time we were recording, that he was pretty smart about what he was doing.
Well, and he nobody has a high IQ, him. Too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the fact that when she was like, "Let me just go talk to my family," he was like, "All right, I'll give you a couple minutes." That felt weird to me.
I think that he was just, it is weird, but I think that he just really wanted a loving wife. And he thought that Josefina had finally, like,
broken.
Gotten there.
He finally convinced himself that he'd broken her and she would be.
Yeah, because, like, she, like, would cook for him. They would watch movies together. She went on outings with him and there was no problem there. And then she helped abduct one of the girls.
And torture one. So
No. She helped torture several. He would make her beat the other girls because she was remembered the boss.
Yeah.
And that's why the other girls hated her and thought that she was in on it. But she was just doing it all to gain his trust. And so... I think after she helped abduct Agnes, she was like, "Listen, I'm not going anywhere, bud. So let me go say goodbye to my family, and then I'll be with you forever. Like, it's cool. And he was just like, she's done so much to prove herself. And then also he had that letter that I think made him feel very secure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, back to his church. Even after he was arrested, his congregation kept meeting up.
Strange.
I think that they probably had to relocate because his house was a crime scene. But
you think?
Yeah.
Do you think if somebody else volunteered, they're like, oh, we can do it at my house. Do you think everybody else is like, let us check your basement first. Let us look around.
It was reported after Heidnik's arrest that much of his congregation were... His congregation was consisted of several mentally disabled people. That was really... He really... preyed on them. I think that when he went into the institutions for his schizoid personality disorder, he discovered that they were really...
impressionable.
He could really manipulate them. Because even though he did have that the schizoid personality disorder, he still had a very high IQ. Very high IQ.
It's too early.
Yeah, I can't. I feel like a high IQ should just be called a high Q. Mm.
Oh, that's so good.
So he enjoyed taking advantage of them and manipulating them. It was reported that some of the members of his congregation actually assisted in the torture. So one follower named Tony Brown thought of himself as Gary's best friend. And he had helped Gary. Later, he needed a lawyer. So Brown's lawyer reported that he too was a victim of Gary Heidnik. So, yeah, he really... took advantage. Gary hired Chuck Peruto to defend him. After their first meeting, Chuck decided that Gary was either very evil or very insane. Only one of those is a defense, so he chose to go the insanity route.
Got it.
That's right. You said something in the last episode about when they tried to claim insanity.
Yeah, like
he, oh, that he said that he like fed the one girl to the other girls, and then his attorney was like, no,
I made that up.
He just wanted to sound crazier.
Yeah, Gary was always well dressed and reportedly handsome prior to his arrest. Neighbors quickly noticed that he was showing up to court looking more like Manson than himself. Later, Chuck admitted to being behind his appearance, saying, quote, if you want to demonstrate that someone is insane, then they gotta fucking look insane. During the trial, he looked like a total whack job. Did I do that? Yes. But doesn't women organized against rape dress up their victims? Chuck also later admitted to starting the rumor that Gary Heidnik was a cannibal, even though there was no evidence of that.
It's a bold move, Chuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I thought you were going to quote Dodgeball.
Oh, it's a bold move, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for him.
That fits. Let's see if it pays off for him.
Yeah.
At Gary's arraignment on April 23rd, 1987, he claimed that the women were already in the house when he moved in.
What?
What? I inherited these women from the previous owner.
I'm pretty sure they came with the deed. Like, I got the toilets, I got the washing machine, and I got the women in the basement.
I have never heard that fucking excuse before.
I wasn't going to kick them out. Do you think I'm a monster?
Yeah, this is their home. Like that.
Oh my god.
Goofy. Absolutely goofy.
It's another bold move, Cotton.
Yeah. He's all for him.
At the arraignment, Gary's victims testified, as well as Dr. Paul Hoyer, the county ME. After all the testimony, Gary was indicted and held for trial. The trial began on June 20th, 1988. Judge Lynn Abraham was presiding. Chuck tried to prove that Gary was legally insane. He called a psychiatrist, Clancy McKenzie. Dr. Clancy McKenzie. for testimony. Mackenzie had some theory that Heidnik was suffering from a kind of schizophrenia that caused him... All right, so pay attention, because this... You're going to need to pay attention for to connect this web.
Okay.
He suffered from a kind of schizophrenia that caused him to revert to the mental state of a 17-month-old infant. Mackenzie said that the condition was rooted in a trauma Heidnik experienced in childhood and was triggered when his wife left him and sent him a letter saying she had borne a child. Dr. Mackenzie reached this conclusion based on the fact that Heidnik's mother gave birth to Terry when Gary was 17 months old. He said that when Betty left Gary and announced she had had a baby, he reverted back to when his mom left him and gave birth to a baby.
Couple things.
Yeah.
One, I'll start with, I feel like, the least relevant. Not everything is traumatic for children.
Yeah.
And getting a new sibling isn't something that turns you into a serial killer later.
I hope
I
not.
Like, I feel like everything is trauma coded now. Like, everything doesn't have to be trauma.
Yeah, second, I mean, that was a testimony in 88, so it's not really now.
That's true. I think that my statement still applies. Second, what 17-month-old is chaining up women in their basement and torturing them?
Can I respond?
Yes, please.
I think that it's more of just less the motive. Like, I think it's more 17-month-olds don't really have the
mental capacity,
the consequences. They act more on, like, not instinct. Like, I want that ball. I know that kid is playing with that ball, but I want the ball. So I'm going to take the ball. What is that called? You know what I mean, though.
Yeah.
Like, I think psychiatrist is like, he's not capable of looking at the consequences of his actions. He's just, I want that woman. I'm going to take that woman.
And that's because his mom had a baby when he was 17 months old. Yes.
No, Lacey. That's not because his mom had the baby. It's because his wife had a baby. Yeah. And left him. Yeah. Because
Wasn't he abusive before this, though?
Yeah, he raped his wife. That's why she left him.
That's because his mom had a baby when he was 17 months old.
Yes.
Got it.
Cool. I'm really liking all of their, like, excuses and stuff.
I feel like they're throwing everything at the wall, just seeing what sticks.
Yeah, like something out of this pot of crazy has to work for this jury.
Mm-hmm. So, like you, the prosecution also tore that theory apart.
Nice.
Next, Dr. Kenneth Cool was another psychiatrist that...
Dr. Cool?
Yeah. They've got some really cool names.
Groovy.
But it's not spelled with a C. It's spelled cool, like Kool-Aid.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Case fun. Or cooler.
Yeah. Dr. Kenneth Cool.
Oh, yeah.
The defense called him after Clancy, and he testified as to Gary's longstanding schizophrenic illness. Dr. Cool testified that Gary's schizophrenia affected him in such a manner that it prevented him from knowing the difference between right and wrong. It was Dr. Cool's opinion that Gary's acts were based on a systemized delusion that God wanted him to produce a number of children, and this was essentially to him like a pact with God.
So he's making him into, like, a cult leader?
I mean, I think you could argue that he's already a cult leader because he started his own church.
Yeah.
But, God came and told Gary, like, hey, bro, I want you to have, like, a whole litter. So, like, just don't make it happen. Peace out.
By any means necessary.
Gary was like, I pinky swear to you, God, that I will have a whole litter of children. Pinky swear. And so, obviously, you know, he had to.
I love your conversation with God, Drew.
Thank you.
The dialogue is amazing.
I think it's exactly how it works.
Yeah, I mean, God's real chill.
Have you read the Bible?
The third expert called by the defense was Dr. Jack Apache. I don't know how to say his last name.
All right.
Judge Abraham didn't allow a lot of his testimony. She said that Dr. Jack did not interview Heidnik himself, nor did he interview the authors of hospital records he referred to during his testimony. So
where the fuck is he here then?
To provide hearsay.
Oh, okay.
You know that shit that's not admissible in court?
Yeah.
All that.
So important.
Dr. Jack claimed to have read through all of Gary's records, but when the prosecution questioned him, it was clear he had not.
Mm.
Dr. Jack...
Just the highlighted portions.
He skimmed. There's so many records.
You want him to read the entire record?
God. He's been in and out of mental institutions since he was, like, 18.
That's a lot.
30 years ago. It's a lot. Dr. Jack said he felt tortured on the stand, which in the context of the case seems like a poor choice of words.
Yeah. Disrespectful almost.
Yeah. Dr. Jack pointed out that Heidnik had 22 legitimate hospitalizations for mental problems. He'd been examined by hundreds of doctors, diagnosed with a psychological disorder, prescribed medications, and he'd attempted suicide. So obviously, insane.
Obviously.
Some more, you know, spaghetti against the wall. Chuck tried to claim that Heidnik suffered permanent brain damage after being subjected to experiments with LSD while enlisted in the Army. The Army refused to release information, and Judge Abraham forbade Chuck from raising the issue again since there was no supporting evidence.
That's kind of like a conspiracy theory. But
yeah, and the judge was like, stop throwing spaghetti against the wall. You need something.
Can you all provide, like, legit evidence? Like, that'd be nice.
Yeah. Then Chuck then asked the judge to instruct the jury to consider the possibility that Josefina Rivera was actually an accomplice of Gary Heidnik's. Judge Abraham answered that she would be prepared to do so as long as he understood that this would indicate to the jury that if Heidnik was capable of enlisting the aid of an accomplice, then he was clearly not insane. So she was like, I will do that, but then you're also kind of claiming he's not insane. Chuck decided not to pursue that point. He was really putting all his eggs in the insanity basket.
I mean,
the prosecution, led by Charles
just plead
Gallagher,
out,
led by Charles Gallagher III, refuted the claim of insanity by calling several witnesses. Robert Kirkpatrick was Gary's financial advisor at Merrill Lynch. So remember how Gary had invested $1,500 and then he had amassed over $500,000?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Robert described Gary as an astute investor who knew exactly what he was doing. So
it's hard to be insane when you're good like that.
Yeah. The prosecution also called a psychiatrist, Dr. Robert Sadoff. He testified that he tried to interview Heidnik, but Heidnik refused to respond to any questions. Dr. Sadoff thereafter reviewed Heidnik's extensive medical and psychiatric history, as well as information involving his financial dealings and his prior involvement with the criminal justice and family court systems. It was Dr. Sadoff's opinion that although Heidnik suffered from schizophrenia, his conduct during the relevant time indicates that his cognitive ability was intact and that he was able to understand the nature and quality of his acts at the time. So, I don't know if you remember. September-ish is when Betty gave birth to Jesse, their son. And that shortly after that, she took Gary to court for child support.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
he abducted Josefina in November. So he was going to court while he had women in his basement.
He was going to court and holding meetings in his home.
Yes. And this psychiatrist was like, based on like how he was behaving in court, he wasn't insane at that time.
Mm-hmm. I like the psychiatrist. He sounds reasonable.
He's for the prosecution, so.
The prosecution also called Ernestine Simpson, a social worker at a state hospital in New Jersey, She testified that she'd interviewed Gary Heidnik in the fall of 1986 in order to determine whether he was sufficiently responsible to escort a patient off hospital grounds. She determined that he was sufficient and recalled finding him to be neat, clean, courteous, calm, rational, and intelligent. I would like to know more about which patient she let him take off the grounds, because at that time he was kidnapping people.
And also, like, what's part of her testing for that to vet him that he's okay? Did the prosecution bring up the fact that he made the one girl write a letter to her family just so they would stop calling or, like, stop, like, digging into him?
They did mention how he was covered his tracks.
Yeah, because that's not something an insane person would do.
Yeah, no, and the one guy's argument, the 17-month-old theory, was like he didn't understand a right from wrong and consequences, but he went out of his way to make sure that he wasn't going to be caught.
Yeah, he had Shirley write letter or no, like Christmas cards. He had
Josephina. He went up to like New York to like mail them, right?
Yeah. Then he had Josephina write that letter claiming partial responsibility for Debbie's death. Mm-hmm. And then he went to, I would say, excessive lengths to dispose of the bodies. He dismembered Shirley, and then he drove to New Jersey with Debbie.
Yeah. That's not something an insane person would do. Did his lawyer know that?
Yeah. Okay. I think that his lawyer was like, the only possible way we can, like, I think that he was just like, the only thing that we can do is plead insanity.
Yeah.
Plus, he kept, like, starting rumors, so maybe he thought.
He's like a girl in high school.
Yeah. Shirley Carter, an acquaintance of Gary Heidnik's, was also called as a witness for the prosecution. She testified that she spoke with Gary in October and November of 1986, and he appeared to be same as he always had been. Harold Wexler was a court reporter who was called to testify after the proceedings he recorded while serving in family court in January of 87. So he had, at that time, I think at that time he had 5 women in his basement, and they were all still alive while Gary was in court talking about child support. Gary was described as behaving in a cunning and deceptive way while answering questions regarding his true financial worth and his obligation to support his ex-wife and son. So he was trying to, like, lie. And they were like, I don't know if he was insane. Additional testimony came from David Pliner, the car salesman who sold Gary his Cadillac in November 1986, and Dr. Richard Hull, like a hole in the backyard, a psychiatrist at the Veterans Clinic. Dr. Hull testified that in December of 1986, Gary came to him seeking treatment. At that time, Gary had denied having any psychiatric symptoms, including anxiety, hallucinations, depressions, or delusions. He next saw Gary in January and February of 87 and testified that he saw no ongoing problems at that time. So I feel like that's pretty damning.
Yeah.
That he saw a psychiatrist and told the psychiatrist, no, I'm not having anything.
Okay, cool. But couldn't people lie?
That's a good point. Are you working for the defense?
No, I'm just trying to... I like to see both sides of the story.
Oh, okay. This is a name that I'm going to spell for you.
Oh, boy.
Eva W-O-J-C-I-E C-H-O-W S-K-I.
It sounded
long. Mike Wachowski.
Wachowski? She was a court... She was a court psychologist who administered an IQ test to Gary in March of 1987 when he tried to gain custody of his son. I don't know why we needed that. He applied for child. He wanted to take his son from his ex-wife. And so they were like, let's give him an IQ test to see.
Just to see if he's, like, really above average?
Well, the only thing that I can think of is, like, maybe they saw his medical records and they were like, he might have a mental disorder. Let's see if he's capable of taking care of himself and others.
Interesting.
On June 24th, 1988, Judge Abraham told both the prosecution and the defense to find more authoritative witnesses to back up their positions on Heidnik's sanity. She was like, the clowns that you guys are bringing in are not sufficient. Do better. So, throughout the trial, Gary sat trance-like, wearing a black Hawaiian shirt and tan pants every day.
That was his insane look.
Yeah. Well, he wore it every day. The judge had to issue a court order forcing him to bathe before coming to court the following day after his defense attorney told her that he hadn't showered in over a month.
Ew.
Gary continuously denied all the allegations made against him, and he claimed that Sandra was murdered by the other captives because they found out she was a lesbian.
That's another bold move, Cotton.
Yes, Lacey. Captives that just were in his house.
Don't you hate when that happens?
I think he's the real
one. They kill one of them. You know what I mean? You're just living your life and you end up with these chained up women in your basement who won't
and
leave.
And he can't call the police because then they're going to blame him.
Yes. And then they go and they kill one of the other ones? I mean, what do you do? You know?
Yeah. I mean, he has no problem with lesbians, but clearly the other women did.
Yes. So he's got these homophobic women squatting in his basement.
That's probably why they were chained up.
Mm.
The previous owner of the house found them and was like,
I've had enough of this.
Yeah, this homophobia will not stand. It did call into question why he kidnapped Sandra then.
That was that peer pressure.
Yeah.
They wanted a friend.
He said, please.
So, I think that this won't surprise you, but the jury rejected Gary Heidnik's insanity defense.
Oh, I'm
shocked.
What? They found that Gary was legally sane when he abducted the six women and murdered two of them.
He didn't abduct six. They were there in his basement when he bought the house.
You're right.
God.
His bold moves did not pay off.
On June 30th, 1988, after 16 hours of deliberation over 2.5 days, the jury had reached a verdict. Betty Ann Bennett, the jury foreperson, read the verdict. Gary Heidnik was found guilty.
No.
I don't know why I was going to try and leave you in suspense there. I started this whole two series.
You said he got executed.
Exactly.
I'm actually surprised it took the jury 2 days.
2.5 days.
Probably had a lot of evidence and had to pretend to go over it.
Mm. Well, there were a lot of counts to also go over.
That's fair.
He was found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder, 6 counts of kidnapping, 5 counts of rape, 4 counts of aggravated assault, and 2 counts of involuntary deviant sexual intercourse. The following day, on July 1st, 1988, the jury decided that Gary Heidnik should receive the death penalty for his crimes. So I think they also had to vote on that. Judge Abraham sentenced him to death, plus an additional cumulative term of imprisonment of 150 to 300 years. So, like, if he didn't die, he'd also 300 years.
I love it when they do that, but also, like, it doesn't make sense.
Well, so I think... I would need to look more into this, but I think recently there was a guy that was on death row, and he was technically dead for like a minute, and then he came back, and he was like, oh. I've served my, that was my death sentence. I did that.
Yeah, I did hear about that. So can I leave
now? Mm-hmm. So I think in this case, if that were to happen, go right back to prison. 150 years. You have
more years.
Yeah. Heidnik claimed that he wanted to be put to death because the execution of an innocent man would stop the death penalty in America. That would be the thing.
Hmm.
After being sentenced, Heidnik was incarcerated at the State Correctional Institution in Pittsburgh. In January 1989, he tried to commit suicide by taking extra Thorazine, which he'd been prescribed. He was just, like, hoarding his pills. Another inmate, whose cell was next to Heidnik's, was interviewed on a podcast and said that when the power went out, there'd be, like, a hush over the entire unit. And then Heidnik would make noises and sounds imitating what his victims would do.
Oh, yeah, I showed you that TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other inmates would be beating on the doors, flushing their toilets, trying to drown out the noise. Gary Heidnik did not fight his execution, but his 21-year-old daughter did.
It's another bold move.
Yeah. Little is known about Jesse John Disto and Gary Jr., but Maxine Davidson White argued that her father lacked the mental competence to make his own legal decisions. I know what you're thinking. Did she just crawl out of the woodwork? Seemingly so. On April 15th, 1997, Heidnik was scheduled for execution, but just hours before, Maxine's efforts succeeded in blocking his execution. The state Supreme Court issued a stay, pending a competency hearing. Over the next several months, various appeals court judges at both the state and federal levels had said that Gary was competent to make his own decisions. So the governor, Governor Ridge at the time, signed his death warrant on May 12th. The night before his execution, on July 5th, 1999, a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, in a 2-1 vote, declined to halt the execution. Maxine was a Temple University pharmacy student. After she got that, she then asked the full Third Circuit Court to consider the case. When the court refused to do so, Maxine immediately filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court notified the governor's office shortly before 10 p.m. on July 6th that it would not intervene. So as Maxine worked to save his life, Heidnik was 55 now and was transferred from his solitary confinement cell in Pittsburgh to Rockview. He was placed in a holding cell where he spent a quiet afternoon either lying in bed or pacing. They gave him the option to watch TV or listen to the radio. Gary chose to listen to country music. At 4:45 p.m., Heidnik was taken to a visiting area where he spent an hour with his daughter. Afterward, he had his final meal. Remember, it was black coffee and pizza.
Oh, yeah.
It's worth noting, Maxine didn't know Gary was her father until shortly before he was arrested. So she, like, formed a real quick bond.
Yeah, with a man who had tortured and raped and killed.
Mm-hmm. On July 6, 1999, at 10:29 p.m., Gary Michael Heidnik was executed by lethal injection. At the time of his death, no member of his family had made arrangements to claim his body. He was cremated, and it's unknown what became of his ashes.
His daughter didn't want him?
I guess not.
Interesting.
That's,
crazy.
Sandra's sisters. Following his trial. Gary Heidnik, as well as Ed Gein and Ted Bundy, were the three inspirations for the character Buffalo Bill in the Silence of the Lambs movie. James Gum, or Buffalo Bill, kidnapped women and left his victims in a pit in his basement. See? You see the run I'm on? In the years since being freed, his surviving victims continued to be haunted. Josephina was forced to go to a dark place in order to gain Heidnik's trust, and the other survivors were left with mixed feelings towards her. Jackie Askins, during an interview, described blaming Josephina for a lot of what happened. All the women have described suffering from intense flashbacks and other PTSD symptoms, as well as various degrees of hearing impairment because of the screwdrivers.
Right.
Josephina told the Philadelphia Inquirer that following the trial, she returned to sex work for about a year. Then she eventually gave it up, as well as the drugs, for good. She worked as a waitress, a security guard, and a daycare worker, and she reunited with her three kids. She now lives in Atlantic City with her husband, enjoying the beach, and still working through her trauma, but her panic attacks are less frequent. Jackie Askins still lives in Philly and cleans houses. She's close with her two sons and is on medication to deal with the trauma, but she still cannot enter a basement. Charles Gallagher, the prosecutor, is still haunted to this day. He said that after the verdict was read in court, something dawned on him, and he began to wonder about Anjanette Davidson. Remember her? No. She was Gary's living girlfriend, and then he kidnapped her sister and went to jail, and when he came out, he couldn't find her.
Mm.
She's also Maxine's mom.
Okay.
After the birth of Maxine, they were told that they could not take care of her because they were incapable of taking care of her properly. That was the last official record of Davidson. During the trial for Heidnik's abuse of her sister, Alberta, Anjanette could not be found, and as of 2021, her whereabouts are still unknown. Gallagher believes that Heidnik killed her.
Mm.
And that is the story of Gary Heidnik.
It was a journey.
It was a journey. I thought it was a good timing because I think Bailey's going to be doing Ted Bundy soon.
I will be.
Oh.
And then all we have to do is Ed Gein, and then we can really understand Buffalo Bill.
Hmm. Lacey, you're Ed Gein.
I'm on it.
Any final thoughts?
I really enjoyed all of his attempts at his insanity.
Well, I had a feeling you were going to mention that, so I was going to say, as of 2021, his defense attorney, Chuck, mentioned that if he had gone to trial now, he wholly believes he could have gotten him off for insanity.
Because he thinks people now are more likely to buy all the bullshit he was selling? Interesting.
Yes.
I am so glad that that didn't work out for him, because I would have been furious if they came back and accepted the insanity defense.
All right. Well, that was sinister.
We were sarcastic.
And we hope you keep listening.